Great. So the first source on our sheet about why Tisha B'Av still matters, as I said, is a teensy bit controversial. I started with something to wake everybody up at 9 o'clock in the morning. This text from Rabbi Elise Goldstein on why she's not fasting on Tisha B'Av. And the thing that stuck out to me most from this text was her very negative perception of the Beit HaMikdash that led to a very positive feeling about the things that happened afterwards. And the question for me was, can we separate those two things? Right? I think a lot of the things she was saying about developments in Judaism that have happened are things that I personally agree with, right? There are certain positive things to democratization of Judaism and development of interpretation and sort of the development of Judaism from a cult worship-based religion to a text-based interpretive religion, I think is something that obviously very much influences us as people who are sitting here with text studying instead of sending Karbonot to the Beit HaMikdash. But I don't think that accepting those positive developments has to mean having this negative perception of the Beit HaMikdash that she has, right? What's the sense that you got from her about how she felt about the Beit HaMikdash?
It promotes elitism?
Right. It was based on a classist society, all sorts of negative things, some of which may be true, right? There certainly are descriptions of definitely at the end of the time of the second Beit HaMikdash when the Beit HaMikdash was under the control of the Sadducees, who were a sect who were to some extent elitist and who weren't necessarily representative of the text-based tradition. So there was a sense that the Kohanim had this leadership role. But I think the thing that really bothered me was that was all she could see of the Beit HaMikdash, right? That she saw that sort of the negative outcome as the essence of it, where I felt like there were a lot more positives, right? And there was an ideal of the way the Beit HaMikdash could serve the Jewish people that she was completely missing out on. And so what I want to do as we go through these texts is to, throughout learning about the history of Tisha B'Av and the way we mark Tisha B'Av, to also figure out what is it that we're actually mourning, right? Why is it that this is something that's so important?
We also have to put the Beit HaMikdash in context of the times that they were living in. I mean, that's right. Very important.
Right, this idea that she's sort of like offended by the fact that, you know, she's a vegetarian and they were eating meat and she's a woman and she wouldn't have gotten to be a Kohen, to me is a little bit anachronistic, as you're saying, right? Like, yes, maybe we could ask questions if we rebuilt the Beit HaMikdash. What would we do to make it more open and accessible, possibly? Or, you know, would we follow everything to the letter and yet still have it be something that's welcoming and comforting to people? But yeah, she has this very, well, it doesn't fit into my 21st century sensibility. I think that you're right. That's sort of one way that she writes off something that to us still has a powerful legacy. And so that's what's being mentioned in the two sources from Zechariah that are in sources 2 and 3, right? As I mentioned, Zechariah was a Navi during the time of the rebuilding of the second Beit HaMikdash. Now, the rebuilding of the second Beit HaMikdash was not as happy and exuberant an event as you might have expected. The Jews were kicked out of the land of Israel by the Babylonians. 70 years passed. Koresh, the king of Persia, Cyrus, said that the Jews could come back to Israel and could begin the process of rebuilding, but not that many people took them up on it. There were a few waves of Jews who tried to come back. They were mostly impoverished. They had to fight with the people who were currently living in the land of Israel because it wasn't left empty. There were people there. They had to struggle to find the money to rebuild. The Nevi'im Haggai and Zechariah had to push very hard to get people to prioritize the rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash. And it was a difficult time. But when they managed to get it off the ground, when they managed to actually begin, you know, setting the foundations for the Beit HaMikdash, there was this sense that, wait, maybe we should change our position on the mourning that we've been doing, right? They had been mourning 4 fasts because of the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash, and they wanted to know, should we continue? You might notice that the question appears in the beginning of the 7th parak of Zechariah. The answer is found in the middle of the 8th parak of Zechariah. By the time the answer comes around, which is basically one day you won't have to fast, now it's not so clear, That happens at the very end of a long nevuah that Zechariah receives from God that will actually form a main topic of our shir tomorrow. Our shir tomorrow is going to talk about what Tisha B'Av is about if it's not about the Beit HaMikdash. It's sort of the flip side to today's shir. So that's a sneak peek. But by the end of the nevuah, God has said, I don't really care whether you fast or not fast. That's not the important thing to me. So you guys have to decide if you think it's right to fast now or not. One day, hopefully, these days will become holidays. And as you saw in a source that we're going to get to later, the question of what time is that, when do these days switch into holidays, is not one that was very clear. And it was a question that the rabbis were asking generations and hundreds and thousands of years after the nevuah of Zechariah. Just to point out, you'll probably realize Zechariah is one of the last Nevi'im. Right? We have almost no nevuah from the time of the second Beit HaMikdash. Right? By the time we get to Ezra and Nehemiah, who are leading the Jews, again, in this beginning of rebuilding the land of Israel, that's basically the last time God directly communicates with the Jewish people. After that, we were left to the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, who Ezra was a part of. They, you know, sort of established a lot of the liturgy of the Jewish people, but all of that moving into the development of Torah Shebaal Peh with the Mishnah, all of that was done without Nevuah. So the period of the second Beit HaMikdash was very different than the period of the first Beit HaMikdash with regards to knowing what exactly God wanted from you. And Zechariah is very much on the edge of that. So he's the bridge between the first Beit HaMikdash and the second one. These psukim are also extremely important because they're actually the first source we have for the fact that we fast on Tisha B'Av, right? This is something that, oh, of course we know, but the idea that we fast is only found in one pasuk, because again, this is the latest you can get in Tanakh, really, that's going to mark these kinds of things. So these psukim are important because they establish that the fasts of Tisha B'Av, Shivasar B'Tammuz, Asar B'Tevet, and Tzom Gedalia have been around for a very, very long time. This isn't something that came later, which is interesting when you look at the Mishnah in Tanit in source number 4, where some of the events listed that we commemorate on Tisha B'Av happened thousands of years after this event. The Mishnah doesn't list things thousands of years later, but it does list things that had not yet happened when these psukim describe the fact that we fast on Tisha B'Av. So we're going to think about the development of this fast, what events sort of joined previous ones to sort of fall upon this one sad day. The Mishnah in Tanit lists 10 events, 5 which took place on Shivasar B'Tammuz, and 5 which took place on Tisha B'Av. On Shivasar B'Tammuz, what do we have? We have Moshe broke the first set of luchot when he came down from Har Sinai, saw Chet HaEgel going on, he broke the luchot. What else happened? The Karban Tamid, which was brought every single day in the Beit HaMikdash, that was stopped because of the Roman siege on Jerusalem. The walls of Yerushalayim were breached. The Torah was burnt by apostemus. And an idol was placed in the temple courtyard, that during the Greek period in Israel. All of these events happened during different times that difficult things were going on for the Jews, all of those on Shivasar B'Tammuz. On the 9th, we have the Jews finding out that they can't go into the land of Israel. Both two Batei Mikdash were destroyed, Beitar was captured, and the city of Jerusalem was plowed over. I asked in the questions why you think these tragedies were listed this way. Did you guys come up with anything interesting about the structure of this Mishnah?
Yeah, we said the first part with the building up to the ultimate destruction.
Right, the Shivasar B'Tammuz events are bad, but not as bad, right?
Right.
They're all sort of first steps. Anything else? Any other thoughts? So there's one thing I want to point out, which is that when the Mishnah speaks like this in numbered lists, it means that it thought very, very hard about this. It means there are exactly 5, we thought about this 5, and we're paralleling them to this other set of 5, right? They're being set up in contrast to each other, not necessarily as opposites, but as a way of saying that there's something that unites all of the items on each list. This is an idea I saw from Rabbi Yitzchak H. Shalom, who has a whole theory about what unites the tragedies of Shivasar B'Tammuz and what unites the tragedies of Tisha B'Av. So I will tell you, in part, what I think unites the tragedies of Tisha B'Av. Then we'll look through the sources that you've already seen, and you'll say if you think that they fit within this idea, and that will sort of come back at the end to, again, why I think this is all still relevant. So the idea that he presents that I think is mostly really, really true is that the fast of Shivat Arba Tammuz represents different events that broke the covenant of Sinai, the covenant of Torah. God's relationship with the Jews, as reflected in the learning of Torah, was broken in a number of these events, starting with the breaking of the Luchot, the Torah being burned, an idol being placed in the Beit HaMikdash, and I'm not going to go into exactly how this plays out in all of the fasts, because that's not the one that we're focusing on, but he contrasts the covenant of Sinai with the covenant of Tzion. All of the events, all of the tragedies that took place on Tisha B'Av are tragedies of God's relationship with the Jewish people as reflected in the land of Israel, as reflected in the Brit of Tzion, of Yerushalayim. So we're going to go through these sources, some of them more obvious, some of them slightly less so, but I think you'll see that that will sort of add a layer to the way we view what all of these tragedies have in common. So let's look at the first one, which is such a tragic Gemara to me. The Gemara in Sota, which you guys saw, quotes the Pasuk from Sefer Bamidbar after the Jews hear the report of the spies who come back from Eretz Yisrael. They say the land is scary, so the Jews stay up all night, they cry. Rabba said that night was the night of Tisha B'Av, and God said to them, you had no reason to cry now, but I'm going to make this night a night of crying forever. This was the first step in the Jews sort of breaking their bond with God with relation to the land of Israel, right? The Jews were really supposed to enter the land of Israel right then, right? They were really so close, they paused to send some spies in just to check what's going on. And because of this, they ended up another 38 years in the desert. So this is the first place that sort of establishes this problem, right? The first break the Jews have with God in their path to be the nation of Israel in the land of Israel. Right, that's the goal, and this is the first place that we see a break from that. Right, they're supposed to move to Israel, establish themselves, establish a place for God to rest in the land of Israel. Right, Vishachanti b'toch b'nei Israel. God wants to rest His presence among the Jewish people in the land of Israel. Here they delay that, and that in essence sort of adds to the world a paradigm that the Jews sometimes might mess up about this, right? And if there's going to be a day where that's going to happen, it's going to be Tisha B'Av. The next few sources, when you guys saw, were probably a little bit strange. They relate to the question of when was the first Beit HaMikdash destroyed? What day was it actually destroyed? Because there are two psukim that contradict. The first pasuk in Malachim Bet seems to say that it was on the seventh day of Tammuz. In Yirmiyahu, it seems to say it was the 10th day of Tammuz. So the Gemara tries to establish, you know, how did this happen? So the Gemara says it must be that they entered on the 7th. They were, like, breaking things and destroying things on the 7th, 8th, and 9th. And at the end of the day on Tisha B'Av, that was when they lit the Beit HaMikdash on fire, so that it was mostly burning on the 10th. That actually raises the very interesting question where Rabbi Yochanan says, I actually think Tisha B'Av should have been on the 10th. They really should have been fasting then. So they say, well, it was the beginning of the destruction, so we mark the beginning of the destruction. It's interesting to think about, maybe, you know, whether or not they were thinking about the fact that the night of the Meraglim was Tisha B'Av. Maybe when they were deciding, should we fast on the 9th or the 10th, maybe they already had in mind, well, something else terrible happened on the 9th. Maybe we should mark it like that. Or maybe that was a tradition that hadn't yet been revived and they sort of ended up on the same day. But in any event, the first Beit HaMikdash burned on the 9th of Av. So now we have two events, and it's very clear how the burning of the Beit HaMikdash represents a break in the covenant of God with Tzion, right? The burning of the Beit HaMikdash by Nebuchadnezzar led to the Jews being kicked out of the land of Israel. And even further, there were some Jews who remained in Israel, but Jews in Israel without the Beit HaMikdash, we're seeing that as something that's majorly lacking, right? As Jews, we don't fully celebrate being in the land of Israel if it doesn't come along with the presence of God among us. So that's the burning of the first Beit HaMikdash. The second Beit HaMikdash, the Gemara says, well, we don't have a specific way of knowing it, but terrible things happened on that day, so it's very likely. Then you saw in Josephus that Josephus says it was actually burnt on the 10th day of Av, the same day it was the first Beit HaMikdash was burned by the Babylonians. Again, we have decided to mark it on the day before, which was considered the day that the destruction began. Okay, so 2 days, similar things. Again, the Gemara can't fully bring a source for Beitar being destroyed on Tisha B'Av, but we can already tell why it would be that they would mark the destruction of Beitar on Tisha B'Av, because as you saw in the other source, the destruction of Beitar was so bloody, so destructive, and the rabbis, again, give very, very gory details. There are many other Gemaras that describe the destruction of Beitar. How high did the blood reach on the horses who are trooping through the city? Really, really terrible stuff. But the main thing about the destruction of Beitar was that it was the end of the rebellion of Bar Kokhba. The Bar Kokhba rebellion in 135 came 65 years after the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. There were still Jews living in the land of Israel. The Romans didn't kick all of the Jews out after they destroyed the Beit HaMikdash. Some did leave, but they didn't kick everyone out. And for that reason, there were always Jews who would try to reestablish Jewish sovereignty over the land of Israel. And Bar Kokhba was doing pretty well. Right? Bar Kokhba managed to mint his own coins and actually reestablish a Jewish kingdom in part of Israel. And you may know that Rabbi Akiva was particularly optimistic about Bar Kokhba, really believing that he was the Mashiach, that this was going to be the rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash. And when Beitar was destroyed, that was sort of the final acknowledgement. Right? Not only is Bar Kokhba not Mashiach, not only is this rebellion not going to last, but there is no chance of rebuilding the Beit HaMikdash right now. The Romans are not going to give up. Right? This is not the time that we're going to reestablish ourselves in Israel. And again, it follows in that pattern of losing control over Israel and losing control of our relationship with God that's represented by all of that. And so you saw, even though it's sort of against the rules in school, I brought a section from Wikipedia about the history of Jerusalem, because I think it's very, very important context, right? We talk about one of the tragedies that happened on Tisha B'Av as being the razing of Jerusalem, right? That it was just plowed over by the Romans. And in fact, this seems to have happened a number of times in history, right? It seems to have happened immediately after the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. The Romans, you know, destroyed it. But then a few times later, the Romans considered rebuilding Jerusalem. They considered letting the Jews have Jerusalem back. But then in the end, that was all scrapped. Jerusalem was again plowed down and rebuilt as a completely Roman city, dedicated, I think, to the god Jupiter. Yeah, in particular, Jupiter Capitolinus. And that, again, no matter which raising of Jerusalem we're talking about, by the time Jerusalem was rebuilt as this Roman city, again, that was the end. There was this acknowledgement that this is not going to be a Jewish city that we'll be able to come back to. In fact, in that very cruel, ironic way, the Romans allowed the Jews back in once a year on Tisha B'Av to mourn the fact that this was no longer their city. And that rule actually lasted for a very long time. Throughout some periods of the Muslim and Christian conquest of Jerusalem also, because Jerusalem passed through Muslim and Christian hands basically alternately through the Middle Ages. During many of those periods also, Jews were only allowed into Jerusalem to mourn on Tisha B'Av. There were some periods where Jews were actually allowed to live in Jerusalem, but there are lots of historical testimonies from later that say, yeah, those bedraggled Jews, they schlep in on Tisha B'Av to mourn, and that was basically the only connection Jews had with Tisha B'Av. With Jerusalem on Tisha B'Av. So all of these things together, right, serve to emphasize that it's not five different sad things that happened on Tisha B'Av, right? All of these five things are really a continuum of the beginning of the idea that we might not immediately get this perfect settlement in Israel with God that we wanted. Then we finally got there, but it broke a number of times. And each time there was, maybe we can come back, right? The first Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, we built a second. The second Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, maybe Bar Kokhba can bring us back. But every time we have that setback, that's Tisha B'Av, right? Tisha B'Av is about wanting to get back to Jerusalem and remembering that that's not happening right now. And that's why Tisha B'Av is so different from these other fasts. So the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah says, I want to read this one inside because I think it's a great, even just for learning Gemaras, I think this is a very classic Gemara. Da'amar Avchana Bar Bizna. I'm reading source number 14. You can follow along in Hebrew or in English, or Aramaic, as the case may be. Rav Chana Bar Bizna said, Amar Rav Shimon Chasida, Rav Shimon Chasida said, My dichtiv, what does the pasuk mean when it says, Ko amar Hashem tzvako, God has said, Tzom harvi'i, v'tzom hachamishi, v'tzom hashvi'i, v'tzom ha'asiri, the fasts of the 4th, 5th, 7th, and 10th months, those are the four fasts that I mentioned before, Yihye lebeit Yehuda l'sason l'simcha, they will be one day for the house of Judah for happiness and celebration. Kari lehu tzom, v'kari lehu sason v'simcha, they're called fasts, but they're also called celebration and happiness. Bizman sheyesh shalom yihyu l'sason u'l'simcha. When there is peace, they will be for happiness and celebration. Ein shalom tzom. When there is no peace, they will be a fast. Sounds pretty simple, right? Not so easy, right? Amar Rav Papa, hachika amar. Rav Papa said this is what it means. Bizman sheyesh shalom yihyu l'sason u'l'simcha. Yesh gzerat hamalchut tzom. So he says there's actually more than two categories. When there is peace, these days will be holidays. When there is a decree of the government, then they will be fasts. Ein gzerat hamalchut ve'ein shalom, ratzu mitzanin, ratzu ein mitzanin. When there is this in-between stage where the Jews are not under control of some outside government, they're not being persecuted by decrees of despots, but there also isn't perfect peace, then, if you want to fast, you can, and if you don't want to fast, you don't have to. Ihachi Tisha B'Av nami. But Tisha B'Av, then, should also be optional, right? This question assumes the fact that was true at the time, that the other three fasts really were viewed as optional. Some people would fast, some people would not fast. It was not entirely consistent, but Tisha B'Av was assumed that everybody was going to fast. So the question is, why does everyone need to fast on Tisha B'Av if the other fasts, not everyone fasts on? Amar Rav Papa, Shani Tisha B'Av, Hoyil V'Huchblu Bo Tzarot. Rav Papa says Tisha B'Av is different because there was a doubling of tragedies on Tisha B'Av. Da'amar mar, b'tisha b'av chariv habayi barishona u'bishniya, v'nilkada beitar v'nechrusha ha'ir. Because we have this statement that on Tisha B'Av, the first Beit HaMikdash and the second Beit HaMikdash were destroyed, and Beitar was captured, and Jerusalem was plowed over. And he doesn't even mention that first one about the decree that the Jews couldn't go into the land of Israel. So even though the Mishnah lists many events that happened on Shavuot Arba Tammuz, we already could sense that there is a difference in scope between the events of Shavuot Arba Tammuz and the events of Tisha B'Av, right? Even just the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash twice really would have been enough for Rav Papa's claim that Tisha B'Av is always going to be a fast until we have true shalom. Now, as you guys were trying to figure out, what does it mean to have true shalom, right? The rabbis of the Gemara assumed that during their period, they were in an in-between stage. No gzerat hamalchut, right? They weren't being persecuted, but there was no shalom. The question is now, right? Do you think that we're in that in-between stage, or would you consider saying maybe we're in shalom?
They're not in shalom.
They're saying no. No, not shalom. So it's interesting to think, I wonder if we brought Rav Papa here, and we said, hi, Rav Papa, I live in Israel. I get to fly back and forth. We have these things called airplanes. You get to go across oceans. I can go back to the land of Israel where we have a Jewish government and where I can go into the old city and I can pray at the Kotel and I can learn Torah and nobody stops me. What do you call that, right? I have a sense that he would say, wait, that's amazing. That's the shalom we've been waiting for. And then we might say, well, we have all these political problems and we don't have a Beit HaMikdash and Jews can't pray on the Temple Mount. And he would say, that's a little bit more complicated. And I wonder what he would say, right? I have this sense that we don't, to a certain extent, I agree with Rabbi Elise Goldstein, right? That what we have in the land of Israel is miraculous beyond what I think any of the Amorim were considering at the time, right? I think that they would have been amazed at what we've managed to achieve in establishing a government that's stable, if not a government that everybody loves, right? In establishing an army that has managed to protect our country even through wars that we prefer not to have to fight. So that's something that, like, I think about. I think probably the safer option is for us to consider ourselves in that in-between stage, not to assume, right? Not to assume that we can stop fasting on Tisha B'Av. Again, I agree that that's the wrong thing to do, because I also think Tisha B'Av has this power to remind us of what we don't yet have. I don't think that we're at 100%. But let's just point out, the Gemara doesn't say if there's a Beit HaMikdash you don't have to fast. It says if there's Shalom. Right? It's a slightly lower bar. So again, I would prefer to wait for the Beit HaMikdash. I think that's why we fast on Tisha B'Av, because that's something that we're missing. And so I wouldn't be prepared to not fast until we had that. But I also think there is a little bit of, like, let's pause and acknowledge that we've almost reached that stage. So that's sort of a side point. But all of this to say that Tisha B'Av carries this heavier weight as something that can't be pushed aside as easily as maybe some of the other fasts. Now, it also happens to be that at some point in the Middle Ages, most communities accepted on themselves, at least the men of most communities, accepted fasting the other three fasts, right? The Gemara seems to imply that some people fast on these fasts and some people don't. Our communities mostly accepted fasting those three fasts, but are obviously much more lenient about somebody who doesn't feel well, doesn't fast, somebody who, you know, isn't able to for whatever reason. And in fact, there's many women have had the tradition for many years not to fast on some of those fasts, which, again, has history and it has sources. So not writing anything off. But we actually, throughout time, have sort of taken on this level of mourning in a heavier way, right? We took on even more than the sources were mandating. Which is about to come out in part three. Part three is three sections from the Shulchan Aruch that talk about how we lead up to Tisha B'Av. Okay, the lead up to Tisha B'Av has a number of sections. The first section is the 3 weeks, starting from Shavuot Arba Tammuz until Tisha B'Av. Then we have the 9 days, starting from Rosh Chodesh Av. And then there's another distinction, which many people don't know about, and I'll explain exactly why that is, and that's Shavua Shechalbo. Shavua Shechalbo is the week that Tisha B'Av begins. So if Tisha B'Av is on a Thursday, it starts from Sunday. If Tisha B'Av is on a Sunday, then it's just that Sunday. If it's on a Tuesday, then it's just Sunday, Monday, is Shavua Shechalbo. The reason that Shavua Shechalbo isn't something that people talk about very much is because it's mostly relevant for Sfardim. Okay, and the reason is what you'll see right now as we read through the next few sources. Okay?
Isn't it also the 9 days?
So they overlap. Shavuot Shechalbo is within the 9 days, but there is a difference for some people in how they mark those days. Okay, I'll show you what I mean inside, because the Shulchan Aruch can say it better. So it's actually a debate. I was speaking to some people about this. Most people say there is no Shavuot Shechalbo in a year where there is no week of Tisha B'Av, because Tisha B'Av is Shabbos and then Sunday. Some people are a little bit more strict in the week before, but again, it doesn't really make a difference for Ashkenazim. We'll just have to trust me on that until I can show it to you inside. The Shulchan Aruch says, "Meirosh Chodesh Ad Hatani Mima'atim B'Masa U'Matan U'Bevinyan Shal Simcha." The Shulchan Aruch says, from Rosh Chodesh Av until the fast day, which is the 9 days, we limit ourselves in the business that we do, and we don't build for celebratory things. Meaning, you don't build a new house for your son who just got married, a new, like, wedding celebratory hall. We don't plant fun trees, all sorts of things that we sort of limit. We limit happy things, okay? And that's based on what we saw at the end of the Mishnah. Mishnah nechnas av mima'atim b'simcha. That's from a Mishnah. Okay. I'm going to continue from the third line in the middle. Ve'ein nosim nashim ve'ein osin su'dat erusin. We don't have weddings and we don't do an engagement party, or a betrothal party, but you can betroth a woman if you don't throw a party. And you can, in fact, betroth a woman on Tisha B'Av if you're worried that some other guy is going to come and steal her away. Okay. So that is the basic rule as set out in the Shulchan Aruch, what you're not supposed to do during the 9 days. The little letters here is the Ramah. That's Rav Moshe Isserles, who's the Ashkenazi gloss on the Sephardi Shulchan Aruch. And he says, V'noagin lahachmir she'en nos'in mishivasar b'tamuz ve'elach ad achar Tisha B'Av. The Ramah says that our minhag, the Ashkenazim, is we don't have weddings starting from Shivasar b'tamuz. And that, in fact, is the custom that most people are familiar with. Okay, let's keep going. Shavua shechal bo Tisha B'Av. The Shulchan Aruch says the week Tisha B'Av falls out. Asurim l'saper l'chabes. Afilu eino rotzel l'lov shoata el hanichol achar Tisha B'Av. The Shulchan Aruch says during Shavua shechal bo, we don't have haircuts and we don't do laundry, even if you're going to leave the clean clothes until after Shabbat, until after Tisha B'Av. And he continues talking about what laundry you can or cannot do. Let's skip till the little letters. This is again the Ramah. The Ramah says that Ashkenazim are actually careful about not doing haircuts and not having, not doing laundry from Rosh Chodesh Av for all of the 9 days. He expands this, okay? And then he talks about, okay, when you would be allowed to do laundry if you really needed to for some sort of mitzvah. Okay, again here we see the law in the Shulchan Aruch, and the Ramah expands that law a bit. Let's look at just one last source. The Shulchan Aruch says, "La'achar hatani mutar l'saper l'chabes miyad." After Tisha B'Av, you're allowed to have haircuts and do laundry immediately. "V'im chal Tisha B'Av b'yom rishon o b'shabbat v'nidcha la'achar ha'shabbat." And if Tisha B'Av is on Sunday or is on Shabbos and pushed till Sunday, which is our case this year, mutar b'shtei ha-shabbatot bein shekodem atani bein she'acharav. He says there is no shavua shechal bo Tisha B'Av in a year like our year. V'yesh mi she'omer she'na'agu la'asor kol shavua shelfanav chutz miyom hei v'yom vav. Then he says some people will say you should keep the week before, but on Thursday and Friday you can do laundry for Shabbos. Okay? And then we have the Ramah, and again, he says what we've been seeing before, V'noagim l'achmir mitchilat Rosh Chodesh l'inyan kibus, v'al tisporet noagim l'achmir mishivasar b'tamuz. He says, us Ashkenazim, we don't do laundry from Rosh Chodesh Av, and we don't have haircuts from Shivasar b'tamuz. Okay? All of this, if you've been keeping track, basically means that everything the Sfardim do, the Ashkenazim, pull it one step back. The Sephardim, in fact, have no mourning starting from Shivasar B'Tamuz. The 3 weeks does not apply to Sephardim. It is not found in the Shulchan Aruch. Okay? So for Ashkenazim, we start at the 3 weeks. Then, during the 9 days, it gets totally stepped up. Right? And for Ashkenazim, there's no such thing as Shavua Shechal Bo, because everything that the Sephardim take on during that time, we take on starting from Rosh Chodesh Av. Whereas for the Sephardim, during the 9 days, they don't have weddings. But the whole laundry and haircut thing only starts during Shavua Shechal Bo, which in a year like this year doesn't happen at all. Okay? So there's a big difference between Sephardi and Ashkenazi Pesach in this area. I was joking with some people on Shabbos that Ashkenazim just love mourning. Like, we're just very good at doing more sadness. Just have like a tradition of kind of schlepping. And the Sephardim seem to get over things a little bit faster. But there's plenty of history in explaining the difference between these Pesachs, and there's a Mishnah and a Gemara, and I didn't want to bring all of the sources, because all of this was really to lead up to this excerpt from Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. He has this very famous article called Avelu Ishanan, Avelu Chadasha, Old Mourning and New Mourning. And I want to read this, even though I know you guys already read this. Inside, those people who are here, I still want to read it because it's really, to me, essential in understanding the period leading up to Tisha B'Av, and again is going to come back to the theme I haven't mentioned in 2.5 minutes of why I think this is still relevant now. So don't worry, we're getting back to that. But Rabbi Soloveitchik says, the Gemara Yevamot distinguishes between Avilut Chadasha and Avilut Ishana, new mourning and old historical mourning, or expressing the same thought in a different idiom, between Avilut Yachid and Avilut Rabim, private and national communal mourning. The first, Avilut Chadasha, is caused by a death or disaster which strikes a family or an individual. It is a primordial, instinctual, spontaneous response of man to evil, to the traumatic confrontation with death, to the impact of catastrophe and disaster. It is an existential response, not one that evolves by the application of artificial stimuli. Isn't he an incredible writer? That to me is like an incredibly powerful two sentences that describe what happens when people are mourning, right? The immediate response to death that is so instinctual in a person that just sort of bursts out when tragedy occurs, right? That is sort of the normal path of mourning, Aveut Chadasha, right? The mourning of something that's new and harsh and hurtful. Then there's the second category, Avilut Yishana, is due to a historic disaster that took place 1900 years ago. This category is the handiwork of man. There is no spontaneous reaction to some new event which has just transpired, for nothing new has happened which should justify grief. The Avilut is a result of recollection of events. Judaism here introduced a strange kind of memory, a very unique and singular memory. This is the introduction in Rabbi Soloveitchik's article to a theory that he put forward that now many people talk about as obvious, but I think he was the first one to point it out, which is that the mourning that we do during the 3 weeks and the 9 days is the opposite of the way normal mourning goes. If somebody has a loss in their family, right? First you sit Shiva, then there's the period of Shloshim, and then there's the period of 12 months of mourning for a parent. In each of those levels, the mourning goes down a level, right? Shiva is the most intense, then you have Shloshim, then you have the full year where there's, you know, you don't join in happy events and, you know, maybe questions about haircuts and shaving for some, but it's still like separation from community for that full year as you process what's happened. The opposite takes place as we lead up to Tisha B'Av, right? We start with the 3 weeks where Ashkenazim have the minhag not to have celebratory weddings and music, right? We move to the 9 days where the Sephardim take on, you know, those minhagim of not having excessive happiness, right? Then we move to Shavuot Shechalba, right? Which represents the period of Shloshim, right? The period of Shloshim where there are no haircuts, right? Other things like that. And then we move into Tisha B'Av, which has the same mourning concepts as Shiva, right? We sit on the floor, right? Obviously, we don't fast for the whole week of Shiva, but still, we take on, you know, for one day, we have this very, very intense mourning effect. So what we have for a normal person in normal mourning situations is you have this very, very harsh, immediate feeling, right? And then as you process it, you begin to move out, and Judaism sort of demarcates the ways that we help a person move through the stages of that grief, right? Judaism has a deep psychological insights. I've never actually had to sit Shiva, thank God, but from what I understand and experience with family members is that you have, you know, an intense period of reflection, and then you begin to move on, but not to forget, right? Judaism helps acknowledge that transition from mourning to remembering to rejoining a community. The opposite happens as we try to remember the Beit HaMikdash, because as Rabbi Soloveitchik pointed out, there's no immediate feeling, right? There's no, wow, I can't believe that happened. We have to build ourselves up to it, right? In the weeks leading up to Tisha B'Av, we try to convince ourselves that we need to be in that mourning stage. So what we do is we act like mourners, right? What we do is we try to move backwards, right? And try to think, I'm going to leave my celebratory community, right? I'm not going to engage in all of the wonderful things that the world has to offer. I'm not going to eat meat and drink wine. I'm not going to get a haircut. I'm not going to wear my freshly laundered clothes. And then I'm going to come to this one day of intense mourning where I finally feel like I can get into that place of mourning for something that happened 2,000 years ago because I've begun disengaging with my positive environment so that I can get to that place. And this still matters now. Rav Soloveitchik is pointing out that this is hard, right? Convincing people to mourn for something that happened 2,000 years ago is a crazy thing to demand of people, right? It's incredibly difficult to say you have to act like your father just died, right? How could you ask somebody to do that? So what we do is we try to do the actions, right? We try to put into practice the way we would act, and we hope that that brings us to that sort of awareness that we're aiming for. The next source in source 19 is the very end of Gemara Makot. And again, it's a relatively famous story that takes place after the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, but not very long after the destruction. In this story, we have a number of rabbis, Rabbi Tarfon, Rabbi Gamliel, and a number of others, who are walking together. They're walking to Jerusalem, and they reach the Temple Mount, where the Beit HaMikdash used to be. Kivan shehigiu lahar habayi ra'ush shu'al sheyatza mibeit kodshei hakodashim. They reached the Temple Mount, and they saw a fox running out from where the Kodesh HaKodashim, the Holy of Holies, used to be. Okay? Now realize this means that they could still tell where it was, right? The temple was destroyed, but either there were remnants or they remembered. This was very close after. Hitchu hein bochin Rabbi Akiva mitzachik. All of the rabbis began to cry, but Rabbi Akiva began to laugh. Amrulo, mipnei ma ata mitzachik. They asked him, why are you crying? Were you in my mishmar when I mentioned this story? Yeah. Okay. This is one of my favorite stories in Shas. Rabbi Akiva is an amazing character, and this story is very representative of him. So forgive me for repeating, but I think it bears repeating.
It wasn't the first time I heard it.
All right, well, hopefully every time there's some slight new addition. Okay, so the rabbis say, Rabbi Akiva, why are you crying? Why are you laughing? And he says to them, why are you crying? Now, it's obvious why they're crying. The Beit HaMikdash is destroyed. But they quote him a pasuk. Amrulo, makom shekatuv bo v'hazar hakarev yumat, v'achshav shualim halchu bo v'lo nifka. They said to him, the pasuk says that anybody who isn't a Kohen who reaches that place, he will be killed. And now there are foxes walking all over it. Shouldn't you be crying? How could you not be crying? Amar lahan l'kach ani mitzachek. He says, this is why I'm laughing. Dichtiv va'ida li edim ne'emanim et Uriah ha-Kohen ve'ed Zecharia ben Yivrachyahu. Rabbi Akiva quotes that there is a pasuk from Yeshaya that mentions two people together, Uriah the Kohen and Zecharia. Be'uriah k'tiv lachen biglach. Oh, okay, I cut out the middle, but it's fine. Be'uri aktiv lachim biglachem tzion sadat hecharish. With regards to Uriah, the pasuk says that Yerushalayim will be destroyed and will be plowed over, exactly as we see has happened. Bizchari aktiv od yeshvuz kenim uzkenot berchovot Yerushalayim. Zechariah had a nevuah that Yerushalayim would be rebuilt and old people would be sitting in the streets of Jerusalem when it is rebuilt. Okay, so we have these two separate nevuahs. And Rabbi Akiva says, Ad shelo nitkaima nevuato shel Uriah, hayiti mityarei shelo titkaim nevuato shel Zechariah. Rabbi Akiva says that he thought that these nevuah were linked because these two nevi'im are mentioned in the same pasuk. So he says, until I saw that the nevuah of Uriah was actually happening, that Yerushalayim really was destroyed, I was worried that Zechariah's nevuah, that it would be rebuilt, might not come true. Achshav shenitzkaima nevuato shel Uriah, biyadua shenevuato shel Zechariah mitkayemet b'lashon hazeh. Oh, no, mitkayemet, period. So now that I see that Uriah's has happened, that Yerushalayim has really been fully destroyed, now I know that Zechariah's nevuah of the rebuilding will certainly take place. Bilshon hazeh amrulo, Akiva nichamtanu, Akiva nichamtanu. The other rabbi said to him, Akiva, you have comforted us. The story has a lot of messages, one of them being that seeing destruction is the first step towards seeing something as rebuilt. But if you don't see it destroyed, you can't really move on to the rebuilding. Again, this sort of has to do with mourning, right? Until you acknowledge what has happened, it's impossible to move on to those next steps. I also think it's important to point out that this nevuah mentioned the word again, Sion, right? Sion will be plowed over. That's the word that I've been repeating when I talked about what was broken on Tisha B'Av, right? The relationship with God to the Jewish people in Sion. And so there's a parak in Yishayahu, which I think is really relevant. This pasuk that I quoted in source number 20 doesn't actually mention the word Tzion, but it's mentioned a number of times in this parak, where Yishayahu has a nevuah about what the Beit HaMikdash is ideally going to be, potentially in some sort of end times, but the ideal for the Beit HaMikdash is as follows. V'havyotim el har kodshi v'simachtim b'veit tfilati. And I will bring them to my holy mountain, and I will make them happy in my house of prayer. Olotehem v'zivchayhem l'ratzon al mizbechi. All of their sacrifices will be welcomed on my mizbeach, on my altar. Ki veiti veit tfila yikare l'chol ha'amim. Because my house, the Beit HaMikdash, will be a house of prayer for all peoples. This pasuk was the first thing I thought of when I read Rabbi Elise Friedman's article about why she thinks we shouldn't fast on Tisha B'Av anymore. Because to me, the thing that stuck out most from her article was this depressing view of what the Beit HaMikdash was this very dim view of this stratified society and all of these sort of negative things that happen when you have a Beit HaMikdash. And my thought was, but that's not it, right? Sometimes things don't go exactly right, but there are these huge, lofty potential inherent in what the Beit HaMikdash can be, including a place for prayer for all people. Right? The ideal of the Beit HaMikdash, I should have brought more of this parak. The Nevuah talks about v'neharu elav. The nations of the world will stream like a river to the Beit HaMikdash, which will be this place that has been established as a place to connect with God. It will be a place where the Jews have firmly established themselves in the land of Israel, right? It's sort of a variety of steps. The Jews have to get to Israel, right? They have to establish themselves in Israel. God then sort of rests himself in Yerushalayim, right? They establish Yerushalayim as a capital. God rests his presence there. And when God and the Jews can together build an ethical society and build a place that is, you know, welcoming to people, then everyone will be able to come and benefit from that. And so I think that, you know, we talked about the destructions of Tisha B'Av as being about losing this connection the Jews have to the land of Israel, but it's not entirely, I'm losing the word I'm thinking of. It's not selfish, right? It's not just about our personal relationship with God, but it's about what we want to build in the land of Israel and what we don't have the opportunity to do when we don't have the Beit HaMikdash, right? The kingdom that Bar Kokhba wanted to reestablish, the Jewish kingdom, right? It was meant to serve as a model to nations of the world, right? It was meant to be a place where God could rest, but we could also open up and serve as, you know, this light, right? Something that was going to be good for the whole world. And I think that that's something that we certainly haven't gotten to yet. I think that even if we talk about Woodruff Papa, think that we were living in a time of shalom, right? And that's really something I've been thinking about a lot, right? What would people think if they came now as opposed to what we had had then? So on the one hand, we said we have the land of Israel, right? And Jews can live in it. But it's these next steps, right? It's making Jerusalem a place where God can rest and making Jerusalem a place that can serve as a light, right? There's still so much work to be done. And this article that I quoted at the beginning basically is saying we're done, right? I'm happy with where we are. I don't have anything to strive for, right? And to me, it's so clear from the sources we've been looking at that there is so much to strive for, right? There is so much that we had and that we've lost and so much potential we have to build up. And how are we doing on time? Okay, perfect. So I'm going to end with one last source. This is a personal favorite of mine. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel Omer, Kol ha'ochel v'shoteh b'tish'a b'av, ki'ilu ochel v'shoteh b'yom ha'kipurim. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel said, anyone who eats or drinks on Tisha B'Av, it's as if they ate or drank on Yom Kippur. For us, that doesn't seem like such a big deal because we sort of treat them pretty similarly. But in terms of actual halachic law, eating and drinking on Yom Kippur gets you the punishment of karet, of being cut off from the Jewish people. That's the most intense punishment that there really is. And he's saying you have to take Tisha B'Av that seriously. If you don't take Tisha B'Av seriously, you're basically cutting yourself off from the Jewish people and from the Jewish people's history. At least that's how I read it. Maybe he was just saying take it seriously, but I think there's really that level of, if you want to be a part of the Jewish people, Tisha B'Av is one of those essential, essential days. Rabbi Akiva Omer, Kol Hosem Lacha B'Tisha B'Av, Eino Ro'eh Siman Bracha Le'olam. Rabbi Akiva says, if you work on Tisha B'Av, you won't see any blessings in the work that you do. That's actually an interesting halachic question about what work can you do on Tisha B'Av. It's come down to, if you have no choice, you have to work. So you do it, but it's ideal not to, or at least to wait until after Chatzot. But Rabbi Akiva, who we saw is like the nice optimistic one, he says, no, but still, take Tisha B'Av seriously. This isn't a day that, like, fine, I won't eat, but I'll go do all of the regular things that I'm doing. Tisha B'Av is a serious, serious day. V'chachamim omrim, this is the part I really like. Kol ho'sem lacha b'tisha b'av, ve'eno mit'abel al Yerushalayim, eno ro'eh b'simchata. The rabbis taught, the sages taught, if you work on Tisha B'Av and you don't mourn for Jerusalem, that's the kicker, you won't see the happiness of Jerusalem. Shene'emar, simchu et Yerushalayim v'gilu ba'kol ohaveha, sisu ita misos kol hamitablim aleha. Because, the pasuk says, rejoice with Jerusalem and be glad with her, all that love her. Rejoice for joy with her, all that mourn her. Okay, this pasuk is a little bit complex. But what we learn from this is mikan amru kol hamitabel al Yerushalayim zoche v'ro'eh b'simchata. We learn from here that anyone who mourns for Jerusalem merits to share in her joy. V'she'eino mitabel al Yerushalayim eino ro'eh b'simchata. And anyone who does not mourn for Jerusalem does not share in her joy. There's something problematic about this last sentence from a grammatical perspective. If we're talking about the joy of Jerusalem being the one day the rebuilding of Jerusalem and the Beit HaMikdash, so that's something that takes place in the future. Therefore, the last line should say, anybody who mourns for Jerusalem, yizkeh v'yireh, one day will see the rebuilding of Jerusalem. One day will see its happiness. But bizarrely, it's phrased as, if you mourn for Jerusalem, you will currently see in her joy, as if it's happening right now. That's something that's a little bit strange. It isn't true, right? I can fast on Tisha B'Av all I want, and there's still no Beit HaMikdash. It doesn't, you know, happen just like that. And so the idea I want to leave you with, something that I've heard and I think is really powerful, is to think about Yaakov Avinu. When Yosef was sold down to Mitzrayim, it said that Yaakov was unable to be comforted. Right? The sons tried to comfort Yaakov over the death of his son, but he couldn't be comforted. And it's explained by the Mefarshim that he couldn't be comforted because he was trying to mourn someone who was dead, but he wasn't actually dead. You can't be comforted for something that isn't actually gone. You can't get over the loss of something that hasn't left. And I think the same thing is true when it comes to mourning Jerusalem. It's crazy that we mourn for a loss that's been gone for 2,000 years. Right? It was just a building. It's been gone for 2,000 years. You would think we would get over it by now, right? You would think we would have moved on. And you would think that we would no longer be sitting on the floor every year, right? Reciting mournful songs and crying and wishing and thinking passionately about that which is no longer here, right? It seems almost impossible. So we spoke about how Rav Soloveitchik explains how we sort of work our way up to that mourning. But even so, how could we possibly still mourn something that's been gone for so long? I think that you can see a hint to that in this last sentence. If you can mourn for Jerusalem, if you can mourn for something that we should have gotten over by now, it means that it's not gone. Right? It means that it's still with us. It means that it's still present in our Jewish collective memory. And if it's still present in our Jewish collective memory, it means it's not going anywhere until it's rebuilt. And I think that's what that line means. Kol ha'mitabel al Yerushalayim zocheh v'ro'eh b'simchata. If you can mourn for Jerusalem, it means that it will be rebuilt. And at that moment, you can be happy. In that moment, you can celebrate the future rebuilding of Jerusalem, because your, in essence, your mourning for Jerusalem in the year 2016 in Long Island means that Jerusalem is not gone. It means that the rebuilding is coming, and that is actually a source of comfort for us right now. I think that that message for me is so much more resonant than we don't need Tisha B'Av anymore, right? For me, this idea that it's not something that's gone because we have what to work for, right? The message of Tisha B'Av is the relationship between God and the Jews in the land of Israel, in building up the land of Israel to be something that we can be proud of, in working towards that, and in knowing that if that's something that still drives us and moves us forward, it means that it's coming back, right? All we need to do is continue to mourn, right? All we need to do is every year to pull ourselves together, to work ourselves up through the 9 days to that point. And then on Tisha B'Av, we'll really be able to say, if I'm really mourning, it means we're working towards something. And that's why I think we still should fast on Tisha B'Av. Thank you guys so much. It's been a pleasure learning with you.
Thank you. I just sure. have a question.
Sure, please.
If we, when we are